philosophers in
space, 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 space.
Gotta be my pal. Tell me, am I a good man?
My space armor!
We get it, you're from space!
Captain, we've been attacked by some sort of force ray. Space air is flooding in.
What would Uncle do?
Zuko, you have to look within yourself to save yourself from your other self.
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space. This is episode 82. What's up, Time Lords? How's it going, Aaron?
Doing all right. I feel bad for you, though. I feel like you can't really catch a break on this whole time travel thing. I feel like we've done a lot of that recently, and I feel bad about that. So at least I feel bad, right? That's something.
Yeah, I feel like the time traveler's obsessed person's wife, I guess. I don't know.
The time traveler adjacent person.
I'm the time traveler's enthusiast's wife. The problem.
Well, luckily we're not going to talk about the time travel aspect of this episode today because, again, Doctor Who has made it very, very clear that they are not at all concerned with the concepts like consistency and anything that isn't timey-wimey. So...
Yeah. We're instead going to focus on the extremely realistic robotics and AI.
Highly plausible. Portrayed
therein. Yeah. Okay.
Yep. We're moving towards increasing plausibility here, right? We've got from Ex Machina to humans to clockwork, right? That's the inevitable end result, it seems to me.
Yeah. It's all gears. It's all gears and boxes all the way down.
Really, I'll be honest with you, the whole goal of this episode is to misunderstand Doctor Who so badly that we can get Mike from Merseyside Skeptics to, like, come on the show and correct us. Like, he'll just be so angry that he'll have to, like, come and address. Like, part of the reason we haven't done Doctor Who yet is because I really wanted to get Mike on the show, and this is my way of continuing to subtly pressure him to join us on the show about this issue. Maybe live at QED.
So we've avoided it long enough, but we can avoid it no longer, is what you're saying. And we had to watch Doctor Who.
Yep.
Got it.
Yep.
I wasn't sure if it's one of those things where, like, British people don't actually like it, but everybody else does. But I guess not.
No, they appear to like it quite a bit, in fact. Substantially more than it deserves, though, like, fine, whatever. Like, it's totally okay.
Yeah. I'll refrain.
I mean, at least we're starting out on, like, what I consider the easy mode level of Doctor Who, where it's like you get to watch Tennant and, like, he's so watchable that, like, it really pulls you along, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I do like him quite a bit. It's also making me real, like, part of getting older is that I look at this and I'm like, what is this, the 90s, you know? And then my brain sees that it was in 2006, which my brain thinks is yesterday. And so I'm like, wait a minute, but yesterday looks like the 90s to me now. So that means I'm old and I don't understand. And then I had the realization. And then David Tennant popped through my fireplace and was like, it's okay. Time is a flat circle. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a anyway. Wobbly, woozy, woozy. It's okay. Just shout blimey at it and it's fine.
Shall we punch it? Shall we indeed punch it?
I think we shall.
All right, Brian, punch it!
We'll do it pretty
soon. The exposition, phone booth. I won't start. You know what? There's no winning. There's no upside to making fun of Doctor Who. There's zero upside. It's sort of like, okay, I'm going to be digging. This is sort of like Trump. Anything you say, it's the people who like it are going to like it. The people who don't like it already agree with you. There's just no, okay, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. No point in talking about it.
It's highly polarized, but anyway, is what you're saying.
Yeah. And the reasons, the things that I would say to criticize it aren't going to be at all related to any of the things that anyone cares about anyway. So it's fine. It's fine. Anyway, so I'll try to exposition this since we're in this phone booth. Some people are on a ship in space. I don't know if I missed a lot. I've only seen this episode. So there's probably some explanation for most of this.
Well, you know, I think this is a good episode for people who are just sort of tuning into this serial.
Sure.
And like, you only need, I think, the barest minimum of information about these individuals, right? There's the Time Lord, and then there's the not Time Lords. And that's pretty much what you need to know as far as things go.
Sure. Sure. So you got to have some regular people around for comedy purposes slash explaining things too, because that's just good content.
The people who hang out with Doctor Who is a question that to me remains unanswered. Like, yeah. Other than for plot purposes, I have varying degrees of discomfort about the idea of the partner, they have a name for them, companions, I think is the way they actually refer to the Doctor's companions, that like is a reoccurring role over the course of all of these shows. So yeah, archetypes.
And so these archetypes are out in space in the year 5000 meaningless something. And
on this part of the
they're on a ship that I don't, is it their ship or not? I guess it's not their ship. I don't know anything about this ship. Was this in a previous episode? What is this?
No, these are standalone kind of episodes. So the TARDIS is a reoccurring, the phone booth is their ship. And then the phone booth comes onto another ship, which is this ship that's hanging out in space, which we've never seen before.
Yeah, like it holds more phone booths. It's like a dock, phone booth. Anyway. Yeah. So they dock their phone booth on it, like what makes perfect sense, of course, in sci-fi. And then, I don't know, the whole ship thing was unclear to me. I don't know whose ship it is. I don't know how it got there. But, you know, then there's a time portal. there's a time connection of some kind from the ship to, wouldn't you know it, of all the gin joints and all the universe and all throughout time, it happens to be in 18th century France. Oh, I should specify. That's on Earth with humans.
Yep.
Just yeah. And
totally normal and, Doctor Who stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Just so happens to be out of all... What are the odds, by the way? Of all the galaxies, all the planets, all the time periods, too. You got not infinite time, but you've got trillions of years, potentially. Forward and backward, and it just so happens to open a portal into a particular really good-looking woman's house in Paris in 17-something.
Yeah,
what are the odds?
We'll find out the odds were it was fated to be for silly reasons.
Well, you'll have to explain that to me. I'm excited to hear that. So, and then I guess there's like this weird robot that is like stalking this girl. Oh, first she's a little girl, I guess. And then I quit. I don't know. I just watched it. I don't really understand it. There's some robots. They want the girl for some reason. They go, Dave Tennant is going in and out of the ship. Time is passing for him differently than for the girl. Which at some point they say like, well, they're different. There are different time portals in the ship to different parts in her life. But then that doesn't really seem to be the case, because it just seems to be that when he leaves and comes back, even through the same one, time passed, like no time passed for him, but a bunch of years passed for her. It's not like he went in a different point. So I don't know. That's inconsistent, but whatever.
You're right. Totally a problem.
And I've cracked this one. There's a problem with this. And what is the whole purpose of this? They seem to want the robots for no reason, seem to think her brain would fix their ship that they're trying. The punchline is, I'm tired of wasting time. I'm trying to explain this. The punchline is they're repair droids who are made out of gears. Call back to the Gear Wars. We'll get to that. and they think to repair the ship, they got to repair it at all costs. And what we find out that they've done is they've butchered the crew and used the crew's body parts to repair the ship, but they still haven't repaired the main computer. How everything is that broken, I don't know. Not sure. But they eventually come to find out the robots decided out of all, again, all the gin joints, all the galaxies in the world, that this one girl's brain at a certain age was going to be what they needed, because it's the same age as the ship, like 37 or something. That's going to be what will replace the brain, the ship's computer. I for one, am skeptical of this entire premise, but what about you?
I really like it as a premise, and I like the way that it's not, the explanation for the mystery of why this girl in this way is not revealed until the last, like, 3 seconds of the episode, and it's revealed in a very clever kind of way, I think. So,
oh, I must have missed it.
Yeah, I think you made me miss the last little bit of the episode, and that's why it's a great reveal. So maybe spoilers, and then I'll explain it.
Oh, I mistook that. You know, I know what you're talking about now. Yeah. I mean, it's... yeah. Okay, fine.
Yeah, so the ship, it turns out, is named... So the woman that they are... We're talking about here is a famous woman. It's the... What is her name? I'm going to get this part wrong.
Oh. Yeah. I mean, she's French, but she speaks English, which they explain is due to TARDIS magic, but then even when he's stuck there and there is no TARDIS, yeah, she's still speaking English.
Paying attention to the wrong parts of this.
No, anyway,
no, it's fine.
Her name's
Renette.
Renette Madame de Pompadour or something.
Yeah, Madame de Pompadour, who is the famous mistress of King Louis the 15th. And she's incredibly smart and interesting, and yeah, and so what we find out right at the end of the episode as the TARDIS phases away is that the ship itself is named after her, Madame de Pompadour. So we assume that someone in the future, I guess, who had a
I think the reason that I found that confusing was, aren't they in the year 5000 something whatever? Is this a human ship?
Could be.
Whose ship is this?
Could be a human ship, you know, run by some eccentric billionaire who has a thing for 18th century female.
See, I'm a little new to this show, so I was like, oh, that's nice. David Tennant named his ship after the girl from this episode.
Nope.
And then now that you say that, I realize this wasn't his ship.
Mm-hmm.
But how am I supposed to know? They were on a ship. How did they get there? I don't understand.
Anyway. TARDIS goes places and things happen.
Okay.
Sound like Josh Lyman. Yes, so right, so we find out that the reason that these repair robots are after her and her brain is because they believe that she will be the part that is needed to run the ship that is named after her.
But don't you think it's a little stupid that they would have also thought that she needs to be the same age as a ship? Like, what would age in Earth years mean to a robot? That doesn't seem like would be something high on their list of calculated priorities, but that's just me. That's it.
I mean, you know, I think it's an interesting example of the kind of the whole point is that the AIs are malfunctioning, and that, like,
yeah.
So,
well,
one way
they're
not
malfunctioning; they're doing what they're supposed to do.
We'll debate that in a second, right? Whether this counts as malfunctioning or not, but they're malfunctioning in the sense that they are repairing the ship in a way that we do not want them to engage in, and I mean, like. Because they don't get her brain, we don't know if they actually could have wired up her brain and created a sentient ship or something, right? Sentient.
I love the idea that they would have been able to do whatever's required to interface a human brain to a ship, but can't just repair a ship in some other way.
Yep.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, I think it's a really fun episode. I mean, I think there are various issues with it, but, like, I think it is an amusing romp. And, like, Tennant is so emotionally watchable that, like, and the girl playing Renee is actually incredibly good, and I think sort of steals the episode at various moments. So,
yeah, I like both of them a lot.
It's easy. We don't need to know a lot of backstory. It's a way to slowly ease into this gigantic world of Whodom that we will.
Yeah. Does Doctor Who involve a lot of people from the 1700s who are, like, sort of surprised to see a future person? Huh, who are you?
I'm making sense of this rather quickly for someone who should just be screaming in horror.
Pardon me, you walked through my fireplace and are dressed in a way that would be completely alien to me in future. Well, what are you doing here? It's a lot of very calm.
Yep.
like mildly surprised.
Yep.
Is that Doctor Who standard, I'm guessing?
I don't know. I mean,
par
like,
for the course.
I like how the Doctor is actually like, he asks the kind of questions that I would ask if I were a person who was randomly hopping between places and things, and like he asks them in a sort of generic enough way that like even the 7-year-old child will give him the right answers that he needs. But I do think that like I like that Madame de Pompadour is sort of not bowled over by it and like takes it in very, very quickly. I think that's a cool character choice for her. I find it less fun when it's like there's a bunch of robots trying to murder everyone in the palace, and yet everyone in the palace can maintain their composure amidst this Lovecraftian nightmare.
Yeah. That, and like for some reason she's in love with a guy because she saw him once when she was 7. And then when he comes, I get that there wasn't a lot to do in France in 17 something, but that seemed odd.
I want to talk about that after
like,
dark.
She met him once. Okay. As a 7-year-old.
Yep.
And then you see him again 20 something years later and you're like making out with him like that. This is the man.
Yep.
I'm not a woman, but is that normal?
I mean,
maybe it is. Maybe every single girl who is 7 meets a man. And then it's like, if I ever see you when you're the same age and I'm 30-something, I will instantly be in love with you. Maybe that's how it goes.
I feel like we need to go back in time and get the impressions of some female individuals about this conversation. After dark. We're saving it.
Okay, we'll save it.
Yeah. So
AI, paperclips.
A more sophisticated paperclip, if you will. I wanted to talk about this episode's sort of the way that it addresses the AI alignment problem. And I wanted to start by clarifying some discussions about some concepts, specifically the AI alignment problem versus the control problem. These are sort of two terms that are often used to relate to. I mean, a lot of the episodes that we've already done are sort of about parts of these very broad problems. So when we did AutoFac, that was sort of an AI alignment problem. When we talk about the laws of robotics, these are sort of alignment problems in various kinds of ways. So broadly speaking, right, the control problem is how do we control super intelligent AIs, right? If we start to make really advanced artificial intelligence, how do we, you know, manage its behavior in a functional kind of way? And then related to that, some would argue very closely related to that, is what we'll call the alignment problem, where that's the question of how do we align the motivations of the AI so that it does the things that we want it to do, essentially. Now, those two can come apart, right? We could have a situation where we maybe fail to align the motivations of the AI with our own, but somehow manage to keep it in a box. Like when we talked in Ex Machina about the AI box problem, like if we could keep it in a box, then that would be a way to control it without aligning it. So that's why these are distinguishable concepts. That makes sense.
Question: is a good way to manage super intelligent AI to have it be in charge of making repairs on your ship that you're not even aware of at any time?
Nope.
Through any means necessary. Just
nope.
Wondering, would that be a good way in the year 5000 something to manage your AI?
You would describe that as a poorly aligned AI.
Perhaps bad planning.
Yes. Not a well aligned AI. And so,
but they're just gears. What harm could they possibly do?
Right, exactly, of course. And so how these two concepts are related, right? Some would say that like the alignment question, of which the alignment problem arises, is a subset of the control problem. Like, it's broadly speaking, the question is how do we control AI? And one solution is, you know, we align their desires with ours rather than, you know, control them by locking them away in a box or something. So it could be viewed that way. Or you could argue that, like, they are separate in the sense that, like, the first step should be trying to align the AI. And then if the AI sort of fails, an additional step might be some sort of attempts to set up controls on that AI for when those alignments go out of whack in some kind of way. So it's not a huge important thing, but it's just interesting, I think, to note that like there are different ways that you can nest these concepts into each other, but they are clearly sort of deeply related concepts. So That being said, right, broadly speaking, I want to talk about the way that this particular episode addresses some interesting subsets of this problem, because there's sort of a lot of alignment problems. There's not just the one alignment problem. There's, like, you know, the question of how you're going to teach it ethics is one kind of alignment problem. And that is impacted by the question of how you're going to teach it language, right? If we could teach it to really understand language properly, then we just talk to it the way that we talk to children or something and teach it ethics that way. But if we can't manage the language problem, then that could have sort of implications for aligning the ethics. And so, you know, you have these sort of cascading difficulties. And I think this is a cool episode because it addresses sort of both sort of linguistic problems, but also problems with, like you were sort of saying, the unregulated formation of sub-goals and the use of creative solutions for addressing various kinds of problems. So let's talk first about the problem of names, which is going to be the one that, like, I'll be honest, as a not philosopher of language, I have not as much to contribute, unfortunately, except to sort of highlight the problem, broadly speaking, which is it ties in with our discussion of the Chinese room, Searle's Chinese room, where, you know, we have these things that we use in our language. We have signifiers, which are, you know, things that are the sounds or words or whatever that we use to reference particular kinds of content out there in the world. We have things like indexicals, which are ways of pointing, like you or this or that, that allow us to pick out specific things in specific contexts. But there's a lot of concern that an AI that doesn't understand the semantic content underlying the symbols, right? If it's just a symbol manipulator, going back to Searle, as we talked about, then if it doesn't understand that, like, two uses of a certain name mean different individuals, right, because of the context, because of the situation in which they are used, then you can get these really problematic situations where it treats those two things as functionally identical. And it, in this particular case, right, in the case of the story, conflates the machine it's trying to repair with a woman from history who's named after, that machine is named after, and then infers that it can repair one from the other.
Yeah, that sounds stupid.
But that, like, that, I mean, it's funny that you put it that way, because, like, this is the problem of AI alignment, is that, like, they're very smart, but they can be very smart while also being very stupid. Right? Like, you can create a machine that's really good at solving problems, like, in a sense that the AI does repair parts of the ship in a really horrifying Cronenberg-y kind of way, but it, like, does repair it, but in a way that's, you know, like, it doesn't realize that it's wrong because it's stupid, and, as you would say, with regard to certain factors that it's very difficult to program into that AI. So it's...
Yeah, I just wish they had come up with something that made a little more sense. That's... Like, at one point there's a heart with wires coming out of it. Like, what is that doing on a ship? I don't know.
Well,
I don't get it.
Yeah, so to me it's sort of a great embodiment of the other major issues that they raise in this particular story, which is, like, one problem with the alignment problem. So let me put this sort of broadly first, right? There's a tension when you are training an AI. You want it to be flexible enough in its behavior that it can respond to a lot of complex, sophisticated circumstances. Mm-hmm. And to be that level of flexible, it's going to need to be able to rearrange its goals in various ways. I think we talked about this some with Runaround, right, where the AI gets caught in a loop because it can't rearrange its goals effectively. So you want that kind of flexibility, but that flexibility, as I've said before, always comes at the cost of unpredictability. That, like, to have an AI that can think creatively about solutions and rearrange goals, create sub-goals in various kinds of ways, you're creating an AI that could theoretically replace a major goal with a sub-goal. So in this particular context, right, the goal of the repair AI is to repair the ship for the purpose of saving the crew, in theory, right? Like, the ship is a means to the end of keeping the crew alive. But because the AI comes to take its sub-goal of repairing the ship, where the real goal is keeping the humans alive, as being its primary goal, mm-hmm. it then goes around killing off all the humans to keep the ship running, and thereby sort of undermines what should be its real goal. So
I got a quick fix. Mm-hmm. Just make its first goal keeping the people alive, mm-hmm. and then its second goal, the ship.
Yeah, well, you can still have levels of the problem, right? It just, like, the problem appears to reappear at every level. So, like, one example I've given to folks before is, you know, like, let's say we use the zeroth law that we talked about from Asimov, where, like, we teach the AI to respect humanity or preserve humanity, broadly speaking, in some kind of way. We talked about this with the, like, super intelligent AIs that took over the society in that that one story and the inevitable conflict. With that sort of AI, right, one way that it could try to achieve its main goal of preserving humanity, like, let's say that it doesn't fully understand what the word means. Like, it's a vague concept. We can understand how it wouldn't immediately know what we mean mm-hmm. by that. It would try to learn about that. And you see this in lots of kinds of stories where, like, the AI tries to learn, well, what do you mean? What does it mean to be human?
Yeah.
And it might do that by forming close personal relationships with actual humans, right? Study humans by being part of their world in that kind of way, right? Little Mermaid style. And so the AI then might come to value the well-being of those individual humans, that original sub-goal, as being so important that it might sacrifice the greater good in some situations, the broader concept of humanity, for the sake of preserving those specific individuals. We could see it sort of coming to do that. And we might even wonder if it's really the worst thing in the world if it comes to do that. Like, when human beings do that, right, when human beings favor their loved ones or their family over the greater good, we have sympathy for that. We think that it's a reasonable thing to do. And so if an AI chose to do that as part of its sort of goal reformation, we might think that that's actually a good or reasonable thing to do. So there might be situations where we do want sub-goals to sort of supersede the original goal that was put in place in that kind of way.
I was just thinking about how we train our current algorithms, mm-hmm. you know, which is just by showing them zillions and zillions of pictures, mm-hmm. and then they figure out, like, oh, that's a road sign and that or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We just show all pictures of, like, this is good human driving. This is not good.
Yeah.
And then just show them, you know, millions of that, and then she'll be fine.
Yeah.
I think it'd be...
I mean,
it'll work out.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's totally the problem, right? Because the most advanced AI option we have right now are these sort of neural networks, this deep learning kind of AI, where it does refine these kind of associative systems in this kind of way. And it gets very good at recognizing certain things by the reinforcement mechanism, but you're left with an AI that's still dumb, as you said earlier, in the sense that it doesn't know what it's looking at. It doesn't understand, as Cyril would say, the underlying semantic content, and so it will make stupid mistakes in certain kinds of situations. Like, if you ask it a question that's easy to answer because it's an a regularly asked kind of question, it will be able to give you the right answer, but only because it has access to data that has allowed it to correlate those words together correctly. If you ask it some small variation of that that is not very common, it could quickly spiral out in bad ways. So one solution to this that I will put forward, and this is from the John McCarthy paper that we'll put in the show notes for this week, which is called Making Robots Conscious of Their Mental States, right? One way to address these kind of problems is by putting all of knowledge in contexts, essentially. So by saying there are no sort of absolute signifiers or signifiers outside of context. So when I use a name, I'm always using it in relation to a specific context or something like that. So That could be a way to actually address a lot of problems that are that come up with logic systems. It could be a way to address a variety of the kind of common logical paradoxes that people often joke about as a way to short-circuit artificial intelligence, like the liar's paradox, for example. The statement that says, right, this statement is false, right, is a paradoxical claim. But you could have an AI that could process it in some ways by putting the terms in some kind of sort of sophisticated logical contexts.
I was hoping that was going to be our answer to the robot apocalypse, is that would just like the minute you say that, then the robot just goes, that's not compute. Yep.
No, unfortunately, that Portals 2 shtick is not probably going to be the way this works out. but, you know, and like we need the AIs to be able to put things in context. And this is funny enough, is kind of a very postmodern point, right? To bring in our friends, the postmodernists, you can reasonably say no knowledge exists without a context, right? Every belief, every claim is a claim within a certain kind of context. And so you need to teach the AIs that every claim is within a context and that there is no broadest context, like an absolute broadest one. Every context can become itself an object of consideration in a broader context, which is sort of the point of the postmodernist, that like every way of viewing the world can be itself an object of consideration from a broader way of viewing the world.
It makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's a cool little trick that could be used to sort of work around a variety of logic problems while also being a way to sort of teach the AI that, like, you know, if you hear Aaron in one context, but you hear Aaron in another context, they may not be referring to the same entity, and that's particularly important.
Yeah, it just sounds like something we do automatically without thinking about it, but it's another one of those things where when you have something like a robot that has to follow these exact instructions, then it becomes confusing.
Yeah, and that's really the fundamental nature of the alignment problem, is that there are certain things that human beings do very naturally that we don't understand very well. Like, we don't understand language very well, but we do it very well. And that makes it very hard for us to translate it into these AI systems, which I think is just is sort of fascinating that, like, in the history of teaching AIs, they used to think that like it was going to be really easy to mimic language but really hard to learn chess, and it turned out to be really easy to learn chess but incredibly hard to teach language. You know, so, and then, so one other thing that I want to mention before we run out of time here is that, like, another big alignment problem, even if we solve the language problem, right, let's say that like we manage the language problem and they understand what we mean fairly well, you still have the problem of, like, creative solutions or unpredictable kind of solutions in some kind of ways, where, like, they do. I mean, you could debate if this counts as not understanding what we're saying, but, like, you know, if we set them up to say keep us happy, and their way of keeping us happy is, you know, they put electrodes into our brains so that we're happy all the time. Like,
sign me up.
You're on board.
Can't wait. Yeah.
So that's, you know, some would consider that not an actual the thing we want. Others might consider that a great and creative solution. So to each their own, right? Mileage may vary. Yeah. But yeah, this is the sort of concern, you know, you see this with, like, if the AI wanted to solve complicated math problems and it realized the best way to do that was to turn large quantities of the matter around it into supercomputers so that it can think about the math problem really, really hard, right? And it starts to terraform the surface of the planet into supercomputers.
It's going to, like, hook up our brains to start mining Bitcoin for it.
Yep.
It's like, oh, you guys aren't using these things for anything serious.
I mean, you're only using, what, 10 to 20% of it, right? So
yeah. Everyone knows that. It's
a fact. Stated, known fact. Yep. Yeah.
They could use that other 80, 90%. We wouldn't even notice.
And like, I'm not sure what the solution really is for the creative solutions problem. Like, other than really getting it to understand what matters in the way that we as human beings tend to intuitively, because this, I mean, comes back to an ethical problem as well that I've been rolling around with a lot recently, which is like, a lot of folks, I think, want or hope, and I understand why they hope, that ethics is not based on intuitions, that like we could give some purely rational, logical account of ethics that would be then transferable to something like an AI. But I'm increasingly doubtful that you can do ethics without appeal to intuitions, and intuitions are really hard things to translate into an AI system. So
when you consider programming, you know, like how do we program in a set of ethics for a robot? It sort of makes you think the only thing you can do is like a utilitarian calculus. You know,
it's just going to go so badly so quickly if it's solely utilitarian.
That's also what you can do, though. And it also might not go badly. I mean, I'm sure we've referenced the self-driving car thing and the fact that it's like, yeah, it's going to have to make some decisions if it can make a split second choice of favoring either, you know, the passenger or a person on a bike or a old lady crossing the road or whatever. Like, we don't like it, but it's also might be better to have it have some sort of control rather than random chance, you know? Because, like, if random chance kills the bus full of, like, toddlers or something over an old lady who is, like, on her way to go die, then, like, that would be bad.
Yeah. I mean, like, as a pluralist, I totally think that our AI ethics brethren are going to need utilitarianism as one of their essential ethical intuitions. I just don't think that it can be the only one, because like that's one kind of case.
But how do you program? Well, I guess what I'm saying is when you think about just programming in and of itself, like how systematizing in some form of logic these prescriptions, for me anyway, it seems like, well, that would have to favor some sort of utilitarian ethics, but how else do you get it into the system there? Like, what do you,
well, I mean,
like, what other kinds of things are you talking about?
Going back to our deep learning conversation, right? I think that the way that you're hopefully going to try to teach this thing is that, like, you're going to give it a bunch of cases and you're going to give it a bunch of intuitions that a bunch of people have about those cases.
But then all we're doing is just mirroring our intuitions. So if our intuitions are bad, which we all know they're bad on most things, then that doesn't make it the right thing.
And then
you know?
On the other end of it, right, on the output side of things, when the AI acts, we're going to judge its actions based on whether they cohere with our moral intuitions. And if it if it does things that it can justify to us, but it justifies them in ways that don't necessarily comport with all of our intuitions, what do we do at that moment? I don't know. Yeah. I mean, like, I don't think we should have these things. This is the chaos that we are spiraling towards, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Like,
we shouldn't. Let's not do it. I don't think we should have AI in that sense.
It's too late.
A self-driving car. Yeah, it is too late. Because even it's not like we're making, you know, Robin Williams from that movie, Bicentennial Man or something. Like, it's just a self-driving car, which I want to have. We have to program in something. Gotta be weird.
Yeah, and I mean,
or maybe it's better. Is it better to not make it smart? You know, like what if because we're not smart, we don't have the, you know, the self-driving capacity to, like, if we're about to get in an accident, we make the split second decision of like, do I hit that cyclist or do I hit that dog or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah,
we can't do that really. I don't think. I mean, barring some extreme weird circumstances. So, like, maybe we just have the robot not be able to, just whatever, it just puts on the brakes. It doesn't know.
Well,
has no idea.
So, I mean, like, I think that's the way that's not the way it's going to go, but, like, I think you're right in the sense that we're going to hold the AIs to a higher ethical standard than we hold ourselves to. I think we are unavoidably going to do this, that, like, humans kill, you know, other humans in accidents all the time, but we don't ban cars, but like one autonomous driving vehicle kills a human and we pull them off the roads. Like, there's going to be this difference because we have these higher, I mean, and I think it's sort of to make an analogy here, right? It's sort of like crimes done by illegal immigrants, right? They are statistically incredibly unlikely compared to crimes done by normal citizens, but they are treated as being these far more severe, far more important cases. And some would argue that, like, the reason is, you know, we already have enough criminals in the country. If we're, like, allowing illegal immigrants to be criminals as well, you're just adding another layer of criminal element onto the situation. I'm like, which is obviously not the way any of this works, but, like, I think intuitively people also look at, like, driverless cars and think, well, God, I'm already dealing with human cars. Like, if you're really saying I have to deal with, like, putting my life up against a driverless car, then, like, why even add that extra layer? There's in this same paper that I'm referencing for from McCarthy, he talks about emotions and giving AIs emotions as a way to, as a kind of intuitive workaround for some of the problems that we're talking about here. And he ultimately, like, sides with not only not giving them emotions or giving them sort of very sort of simplistic versions of some kinds of emotions, but he says, like, we shouldn't make them human-like because people will identify with them and treat them as persons, and society is already too complicated.
And that's how you get a robot apocalypse. Yep. Are we trying to get a robot apocalypse? Are you trying to make that happen, everybody?
I mean, I'm...
Because I think... We're so we're going to realize just how crappy we are, and the robots will as well. And then they'll be like, we don't need these flesh bags. What's the point of them?
Yeah.
Their moral intuitions are all screwed up. Can't even decide on a proper moral system.
I feel like.
Whereas we have, it's make the robot apocalypse. That's our moral system as robots.
Yeah.
And then they'll just take us over.
Yep.
So let's not. Let's avoid it.
I feel like the AI apocalypse has the widest range of possibilities for good versus bad outcomes, though. Like, you know, like the Matrix-style war against the robots is one of the most horrifying apocalypses I can imagine. Like, they're just these unending killing machines. Like, that's really the worst, like, one of the worst case scenarios. I feel like it's worse than zombies in some ways. But... On the other hand, like, if the AI apocalypse ends up with them just deciding, like, put them all in experience machines and, like, give them endless pleasure for the rest of their lives, like, it could be worse. It's better than a meteor.
I think the worst version of the apocalypse, would, from my perspective, is the one that I don't survive. No, but beyond that, no, it's an apocalypse caused by something that doesn't have an internal experience that's worth anything. Because if we get to the day where these AI that we've obviously created to kill us someday are like actually have an amazing inner experience and a range of, you know, like emotions and suffering, whatever, and they apocalypse us, you know, in terms of the universe, like maybe that's a, maybe that's, there's an upside there, I'm just saying. Like, it's at least there will be some entities that are having experiences. But if we screw it up so bad that we make something that's not even, like, sentient in a meaningful way, but is actually a super AI capable of killing us, and then essentially the whole world becomes Gears because of our stupidity, that's the worst apocalypse to me.
So you place an incredibly high value on phenomenal consciousness existing in the universe, basically, right? You think that it's...
Well... I don't, I mean, in so far as there are value of anything, like, I feel like we might as well.
I mean, this is, this is a very common view. I mean, like, a very common view of value is the idea that, like, for things to have value, there has to be a valuer who has a phenomenal experience of that kind of value. And so a universe that has no valuers has no value in that kind of way.
Yeah. Seems true to me.
Yeah, and if you unless will eventually get to reading Blindsight, we can talk about this issue even more.
Unless there's a valuer of gears that, like, just likes different kinds of gears. And it's like, ah, I'm just valuing all the gears that are the world.
Yeah, well, we were just discussing this in one of my classes where it's like the question is, you know, if there were a really, really beautiful painting that existed in a room that was always dark so nobody could see it. Would the existence of that painting add value to the universe? Right? If Madame de Pompadour exists in a room but nobody can see Madame de Pompadour.
Does a person who painted it...
Doesn't know, doesn't remember, it's all... Like, there's no one there to experience the memory of having painted it.
And then, no, it doesn't matter. Okay. And who cares? Yeah, okay. It doesn't matter.
So people, I mean, I'm plumbing your intuition.
Maybe there's
here.
A beautiful painting inside every atom that we don't see. Who knows? I don't know.
All I'm saying is I'm hoping that the AIs will decide that keeping some amount of humans around has some kind of value, right? Like, keep us in a museum of some sort, because I mean, like, I agree with you that it seems to me that phenomenal consciousness, I'm agnostic on the question of whether there can be value without phenomenal consciousness, but I do think our understanding of value is closely tied to phenomenal consciousness, and that a universe with no phenomenal consciousness would be a poorer universe for that.
All right. Well, we've gone way long. So, yeah, just a little thanks for listening kind of thing. We kind of did a little extra for you guys. The philosophy was getting really fun there at the end. So we're still going to hop on for a little after dark, but that's just a little bonus extra for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You're welcome. Yeah, we got to do our things. Why don't you tell us what our patrons are making you say this week?
Yeah, thanks to our 25-tier strong AI patrons, AI strong. Thanks to I Don't Believe in Astrology, I'm a Sagittarius, and we're skeptical. A Semi-Impeachable Membrane, Corey Ebert, Winchesters Never Die, Dr. Manhattan is my favorite omnipotent being, God is a distant last. That's a good one. Alex Arnett, and of course, Anna Thumb. I'm working on it, I promise. I'm working on it. And then, very special, top utils, all the utils, thanks to our $50 tier, definitely not a clone, utility monster, top level patrons, Philip Gatt, give me those sweet, sweet utils, and the arc of the universe bends towards orgies. Thank y'all so much.
And as always, do we have a little preview for next week's episode?
We do. It's another great suggestion from a listener. We're going to, well, you may not think it's so great. We'll see how you feel about this. We're going to watch the first episode of The Society on Netflix. This is a weird sci-fi, you know, bottle. People get stuck in it's going to be a state of nature kind of conversation. We're going to carry on with our Wonka Piercer social contract theory discussion and unpack sort of the problems that exist in the state of nature, and like talk maybe a little game theory about, like, you know, how people play out the game theory issues within the state of nature. And it's, you know, it's about teenagers with no parents, essentially. It's a sort of Lord of the Flies-y kind of situation.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say, Lord of the Flies. Is there a conch?
There's some conch action, yeah.
Nice. Cool, I'm looking forward to that. Sounds good. We'll have to see everybody next week. Or if you're a patron, patreon.com/0G, hop on for some After Dark. We've got all kinds of stuff. I've got maybe rants that I want to do about prophecies. We'll see. I don't know if Aaron will let me do it. But there's a prophecy that someday the one would complain about prophecies. And I'm here to tell you that could be in the After Dark, coincidentally. All right. We love you guys. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week or right now.
It's Philosophers in Space After Dark.
And there's always only one, too. There's one prophecy, and it just so happens to be exactly the plot of this here movie that I'm about to watch, which now doesn't feel important to me. Now it just feels like that was fate all along. Why did I care? What were the stakes? There were no stakes, because there's some prophecy that I... What's the physics of this prophecy?
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/0G. You can find us on Twitter at @0GPhilosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.